All right, welcome everyone. We are back once again with the Open the Podbay Doors news special. I'm your host, or one of your hosts today, Ian Gardner. I'm joined by my buddy all the way from Hobart, Faden. Welcome, Faden.
Is that a Freudian slip?
I try not to be the host. Maybe I just really enjoy this.
I love it.
I think I enjoy broadcasting more than you do. Maybe I've missed my calling by my, you know, FM radio.
Well, isn't Alan Jones resigning? Or hasn't he resigned?
Yeah.
Maybe there's a calling there.
I just got to get a golden mic and just become toxic with my views, and then I'm in.
Oh, come on. You'd never be like him.
No.
It's popular, though.
Anyway, how are you? What's been going on?
I am good. Lots going on, hey? We're doing so much at the moment. It's really exciting, and I think we should just sort of talk about the event we ran last week.
Yeah.
Huge.
We did. We actually held an event.
First time since when? Since March?
Yeah, first time since March. We had 16 people. This was our summit club for the Innovation Base Series A and Beyond Founders. So we've now got 34 members in there. We had 16 of them in person in Sydney. We went to the QT Hotel in the city, which was fantastic. We had hubs around the country that they were dialing in. So we had 3 people in Adelaide, 3 people in Brisbane, and 4, including you, in Hobart. We probably had another half dozen or so members dialing in from individually around the country. So it was interesting. I mean, a lot of learnings for us.
Bit of mixed results, wasn't it?
Like, yeah.
The Sydney hub went really well, and some of the solo people that were there. It was a little bit harder, I think, with the smaller hubs.
It's hard with the hubs, because when you're in a small group and, you know, your inclination is to start talking amongst your group, even though you want a sort of wider focus from the entire group. So it was definitely a lot of learnings, but everyone, you know, some mixed feedback, but they all wanted to do it again.
Yeah, we're taking feedback, and that's the key. And the key is we're having a crack. We've got to have a go, and we've got to move forward, and we can't wait forever.
Yeah.
And I think we've got to learn and evolve as our industry does, right? So that's what we're doing, which is exciting.
But I tell you what, it was just so nice. And again, if you're listening to this in Melbourne, we're sorry to talk about this, but we had a lovely dinner with 16 of us or so, socially distanced, of course, around a table in Sydney, just talking good stuff about the founder journey and everything else. So
yeah,
really, really good event.
And we had a great time in Hobart. I think the hard thing was the video conferencing and doing so much on video, which was a tricky thing. So we got to learn how to do maybe a bit more stuff in the hubs and work out how to do that. But we definitely had a great crew in Hobart. We're out at Ratho Farm and we had an awesome time.
It's the new normal, you know, so we're going to have to get used to this for a little while. Anyway, we should talk about the show. Like, we've just recorded it. It's been a fantastic show. You know, as ever, founder, investor, and ecosystem leader. So maybe we should introduce them. So Olympia, do you want to tell us about Olympia? She's the founder.
She's just amazing. She's joined a summit club, and obviously she's been invested in by Grok and Tenacious Ventures.
She's from Gotera.
She's changing the world, I think, is what Mike Cannon-Brook said about her, which is pretty damn exciting. She's very authentic and straight shooter, which we love. And she's turning waste into food for animals, which is pretty freaking amazing. So, it's great to have her on the show. She's very smart. She's done so much with her life. It's quite incredible. She's very well-versed.
Who else we had on the show? We had this young lady called Andrea Gardner, who happens to be married to me. So we did it from our living room. Andrea is the CEO and founder of Gelix Ventures that you may have heard me talk about. So yeah, look, you know, she's an ex-lawyer, used to be an investment banker in London way back in the 90s when we met. Startup passion, like you wouldn't believe. So like, she loves startups, and, you know, she turned that passion into a really fantastic, but I'm a little bit biased because I'm an investment partner there too, but it's a fantastic business. So all up, I think Gelix has done about 18 investments over the last 4 or 5 years, led quite a few of them. We've done 4 in the last 5 weeks, which Andrea talks about in the show. But she's a fantastic lady. But as I say, I'm a little bit biased. So she's got some good insights too. And then our ecosystem leader, Alex McCauley. So in some ways, he needs no introduction, but I think we will introduce him. So Alex is the CEO of Startup Oz. Faden, we've known him for a while, haven't we?
Oh, he's just doing a great job helping propagate the industry and working with government as best he can. He needs an AO, I think, at the end of the day.
He deserves one. Super clever.
With the current Alex, government.
Yeah,
he's well versed.
He's very, very smart. Again, very, very passionate about startups. I think he's been in the role 4 or 5 years now. I mean, it's been a little while, and I think he's done a great job because it's, you know, not a super highly funded organization. So again, if you're listening out there and you want to talk to Alex, I'm sure he'll listen to you about getting some more funding and you know, but they've produced the Crossroads report pretty much every year for the last 3 or 4 years, which has helped influence government policy. So Alex is the closest thing that our sector has to a sort of voice in Canberra. So it's fantastic to have him in the show as well. All right. So what else have we got to talk about?
Well, obviously, super exciting news that we've seen ARENA get some renewed funding. The people that we love doing great job out there.
Yeah, they're one of our partners. We've done a few events with them.
We have $1.4 billion in new funding, really with a big focus on investing in early stage, which is very exciting.
That's billion with a B.
That is with a B.
That is fantastic. So good on you, ARENA. What else did we have or we want to talk about? You may have noticed in the intro, we're doing a little advert for the Angel Club from our new staff member, Samantha, who lives in Melbourne. So Faden, do you want to tell us about that?
We're launching a really exciting new membership tier of Innovation Bay, which is around angel investing. As people who know us, we've been running events for a long time now to connect investors and founders. They've been highly successful. And we're really sort of taking it to a new level by creating these micro groups in each city. We focused on a whole bunch of new platforms to aggregate and curate deal flow to them, but also build little communities because we're really passionate about driving the volume of investment into seed, which is really needed at the moment.
Yeah.
These are going to be very special, invite only. You can apply. We're going to roll out the gold and the silver tiers next year, but at the moment we're rolling out platinum with a launch date of early November.
That's exciting. Yeah, I can't wait. It's a lot of exciting stuff happening. So, all right, look, we should get to the panel and talk to them about the news. So, Faden, thank you. I'll see you over at on the show.
Roger.
All right, welcome everyone. We're back with another news special. Time check. We always do a time check. So it is 3:12 p.m. on Monday, the 21st of September. And once again, we are joined by three very illustrious members of the startup community. We always get a founder, an investor, and someone from the ecosystem. So our founder is Olympia Yarger. I can't even pronounce your name. That's a good start. Sorry, Olympia. Olympia is from Gotera. So Olympia, do you want to just give a 20-second intro on you and Gotera?
Sure. We're a Canberra-based waste management company that builds autonomous infrastructure to manage food waste with insects.
Yeah, it's an awesome business. Olympia's just joined the Innovation Bay Summit Club. In fact, I think we talked about that in the intro feed, and we had a first event last week, so that was a lot of fun. Our investor in the show is Andrea Gardner, who is from Gelix Ventures. So welcome, Andrea.
Thank you for having me.
That's all right. I know you quite well. the surname is not a coincidence. So anyway, Andrea is right beside me in our living room cum office. But Andrea's got loads to contribute and some news as well. So that's really cool. And we have Alex McCauley. So Alex is the CEO at Startup Oz. So yeah, Alex, how's Startup Oz going? Do you want to give us a quick intro on that and you?
Yeah, sure. So Startup Oz is Australia's national advocacy group for tech startups. We mostly do public policy work around how to make Australia one of the best places in the world to build and grow a tech company, which means we work a lot with governments and with tech companies and investors. And it's been a busy year because there's been a lot of interaction between governments and tech companies this year, lots more than there would normally be. So we've got a lot of issues that we're trying to cover.
Cool. Now, and in my excitement to introduce Andrea in the same room as me, I forgot to ask her to give a little overview of her and Gelix. So tell us about that.
Well, at Gelix, we invest in really daring founders to hopefully make the world better. To date, we've been working a kind of a syndicate model where we lead investments, you know, decide that we're going to invest and then invite our registered investors to co-invest with us. And we're currently raising a fund.
Yeah, very exciting. Yeah, we're loving it. All right, so look, shall we jump to the news? There's been a fair amount going on in the last fortnight, which is the period that we cover. So, we might start with Alex. I mean, it's good having Alex on the show because his job is kind of to be across the news. So we're always going to have someone to talk to this. But the ACCC talked again about the media bargaining code, and there's a bit of a war going on with Google and Facebook, and that's been continuing. And a few Aussie companies have started to weigh in as well. So, Alex, what's been going on with this one? And tell us your perspective if you could.
Yeah, this is a big deal at the moment with both government and big tech companies. This is, you might have seen, if you've been using Google over the last few weeks, there's been a little link in your Google search that says, come and read our open letter to the Australian government about this new media bargaining code, which the government is proposing. It's come out of an ACCC inquiry into competition. They've said Google and Facebook have too much power. We want to try and regulate some of that power. And particularly, we want to start with media. So they think media companies should be getting compensated by Google and Facebook monetarily for the fact that they're spending a lot of money producing content and that's driving traffic for Google and Facebook. So the government's proposing basically a mandatory bargaining code where Google and Facebook will be forced to give money to organizations like News and Nine, which owns Fairfax these days, in order basically to compensate them for the costs of producing news media in Australia. And of course, that's been a real sticking point for those big platforms because, you know, they basically don't do that anywhere in the world and see it as a really risky proposition for their business model everywhere in the world if governments start saying, well, actually, you know, you guys should be footing the bill for the cost of content creation on the internet. And so there's a real sort of standoff at the moment between Google and Facebook and the federal government around how this is going to go forward. You know, there's been talk from both Google and Facebook about withdrawing from Australia some services. Yeah. That's really come, I think, from a sense that this might actually damage their business models. And lots of Australian companies have sort of started sitting up and going, oh, hang on a minute. If Google leaves Australia, what does that do?
Yeah, and there's been a few, like Mike Cannon-Brookes has come out against it. I think Matt Berry probably piped up on this one. I mean, so who else has been talking about this from the local perspective?
Yeah, I've had sort of informal conversations with quite a lot of founders about this. You know, the big companies, really the ones that are sort of most focused on how the government is interacting with tech in Australia. But specifically, both Mike and Scott have been sort of working behind the scenes to make their concerns known. I think there's a range of concerns that local companies have that aren't really about whether or not Google and Facebook have to pay for news media, but rather about how the Australian government is looking to regulate technology. And if it's not being done in a good way, then that clearly has flow-on effects for the next round of regulation, which might then have some impact on Aussie companies. And there's also a reputation question here, I think. When you're trying to build a global business from Australia and the government is sending a message to the rest of the world that says, hey, Australia's pretty anti-tech, that's not great for your business.
Yeah, and this certainly isn't the first time that the government's waded in and there's been a bit of an outcry. So there's a bit of form here.
What do you think, Alex?
Oh, look, I think fundamentally this is a question about how the internet works and, you know, the model that Google and Facebook use, and particularly I think Google uses, is we serve content in a neutral way and we provide sort of traffic cop directions for people to get to content. I think probably actually people using Google are substantially increasing their likelihood of clicking on news media produced by News and Fairfax, and therefore seeing ads served to them by News and Fairfax, and therefore providing revenue for those companies. So the idea that, and they're talking about really big sums of money, could be transferred from Google and Facebook to those companies seems to me to kind of go against the basic precepts of how the internet's set up. But at the same time, you know, there is a real problem around journalism and the business model for journalism in the internet era. Public interest journalism is absolutely kind of a core pillar of a functioning democracy, and there needs to be a way to support that.
Yeah.
I just wonder whether it's about sort of transferring money from Google and Facebook to these companies, or whether there's a more sophisticated way where we can have a public conversation about that we could think about.
And is this kind of a little bit about the transition from old media to new media? Because it seems to be driven by a lot of old media companies that are maybe being a little bit slow to change here, now a little bit upset, but we still seem to be in this conundrum that new media hasn't really taken off yet and journalism is in a bit of a peril.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that core point about media companies not having used the internet very well in their evolving business models is something that really has sort of upset a lot of people. I spoke to a politician last week who said, hey, I actually thought this was going to be an opportunity for companies to realize if you ignore the internet and don't update your business model, no one's going to come running in to save you with subsidies. But actually the opposite has happened, and the government is proposing to run in and subsidize companies that haven't used the internet well in their business model. So I think there's that question around what is the message we're trying to send here about staying current with technology and using it in the best way to keep your business functioning well.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, what does everyone else think? I'd love to get everyone's opinion on this.
It feels like clumsy somehow. Alex's point around translating a business model to the internet and then back and forth. Like, it just feels like instead we've tried a round peg. Murdoch owns 62% of Australia's media, and we've never really batted an eye that there was a monopoly of such a nature. But, you know, and Google, Facebook's a different entity by and large in some respects, but Google manages the movement of other things by and large. Like, it does deliver its own stuff, but we use it as a conveyance for news, not as a generator of its own news. And so it just feels clumsy and kind of underthought.
Yeah. And Andrea, I know you've got some strong opinions on Facebook, and I mean, there was an article or a memo came out from a former Facebook data scientist. I haven't had a chance to read it, only just appeared in our watch screen, but what's your view on this and Facebook and whether or not we should be clamping down?
I do have very strong views on this. Alex, earlier suggested that, the Facebooks and the like, Facebook and the likes are having, are incredibly powerful. We haven't seen a company ever, let alone one person, in control of a company that has so much power globally. And, there's a ton of evidence that they're, being used to manipulate elections. And I think Cambridge Analytica, before it died, acknowledged, I think it swung about 18 elections in democratic countries in the world to the more conservative political parties. Jaw-droppingly sophisticated and clever. And, there's no Cambridge Analytica anymore, but there's bound to be, there are clearly lots more that have jumped into their boots. And I think this this memo from Sophie Zhang, who I think she's a data scientist, so she's actually reasonably junior. It's just a reminder.
Yeah.
And it's really frightening, I think. And I do think that I can't see it happening. We can't collaborate on climate change and have a coordinated approach. And I do think there needs to be some sort of global regulation pulling them in.
It's definitely a tricky one. Look, I don't think there's a good answer here. And Luke, I don't want to turn this show into the sort of politics. This is a news special, not the politics special. But the reality is that Facebook wields a lot of power. And I think it's prudent for governments to be looking at whether or not they should regulate. All right, should we move on to slightly more positive news? I'm looking at the panel. Yes, they're all smiling. So we saw Mike Cannon-Brookes and Elon Musk. They're bosom buddies, it seems. They sort of tweet each other and message each other, but they seem to be joining forces for this giant battery that they're going to be building up in the Newcastle region. So, Fain, I think you saw this one, Olympia. I think you might have had some thoughts on this one as well. So, Olympia.
How good is it?
Yeah.
I think what isn't great is that I've been watching this whole thing roll out where, anyone that follows Beyond Zero, all those sorts of platforms, and trying to understand why we can't seem to find our way to a federally driven plan for renewables. And I can't decide if it's because... I just always keep coming back to this idea that it feels like nobody can imagine how to build an industry as powerful and as profitable as digging, you know, like coal is tangible and we hold it in our hands, but like to build a business around renewables and how to sell that globally and what, how do you make this business out of this thing that still requires some innovation? And so it's really cool to see the capability to try and meet this challenge that government has inadvertently thrown out there. But I think what's really sad is that that's what's happening, that we require the Mike Cannon Brooks of the world to, you know, take up that mantle. And I think, like, great and amazing, but, like, this shouldn't be how government delivers on massive infrastructure or, you know, do you know what I mean? Like, this shouldn't be the way we manage complex problems. Maybe it's how we evolve and get there, but I know it's kind of disheartening that we kind of need to have this kind of discourse to move something progressively forward.
And I think I saw on tweet this week that South Australia reached almost 90% in renewable power generation. Yeah. You know, and that was previously, you know, the government was like, well, you know, renewables don't work. And, you know, if what's the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing, it's like, well, you get storage. So there's a bunch of things that's going on here that's a bit unfortunate. So, Andrea, you got any thoughts on this one around the giant battery being built in Newcastle?
Oh, look, I completely agree with Olympia. I think it's awesome and it's really exciting. I think it is disappointing that the government is, you know, not leading the way. But I thank goodness that we've got a visionary as capable and competent and willing to roll his sleeves up as Mike Cannon Brooks to try and drive this in the right direction.
Yeah. No, it is terrific. So,
I think the exciting thing here, maybe if we can refer it back to the first question almost, is this weird role that the current federal government seems to be playing at the moment, protecting old media, stepping in and seeming to protect fossil fuels. I know, Alex, this is a weird one for you, right? Because you're dealing with them all the time. I mean, how do you take this stance and how should we be thinking about the current federal government?
The government's in a really weird place at the moment, Faden. It's they're trying to do everything all at once because, you know, economic recovery, save people's jobs, build new industries, save old industries. I think you could easily see the government announcing packages to support gas and coal at the same time as investing heaps of money in renewables. It's just that kind of weird world at the moment. I think to Olympia's point, sometimes new industries need pioneers, and it's really good to see that Australia, you know, has a billionaire pioneer who's kind of connected to the right people globally as well, who can actually make stuff happen, you know, as they did in South Australia. They're both invested in the Sun Cable together. And hopefully we can, you know, that'll lend itself to a more institutionalized approach to renewables here. But it's great that we've at least got that much.
Yeah, and he's so open with it.
And what I can't work out is Ian actually did a podcast with Arena, but he also did one with Steve Baxter. And, you know, Adelaide seems to be a great success story, but it doesn't seem like we're promoting that or there's a consistent message about how well the Tesla battery farm in Adelaide's done.
Well, that's where I kind of get to, not sorry, but like it's sort of, yeah, it is really great to have a pioneer, but then we need one person. And I guess maybe we're just seeing the change and shift in roles of government and truly we are going to have these private sectors emerge to drive innovation because they can do things faster than government. But that also puts us in a tenuous situation around whether or not those people are benevolent or good or within the interests of everybody else. And so, like, absolutely. But the fact that South Australia is still considered this sort of weird anomaly that happened when billionaires had a bet is like a tragedy because the government hasn't leveraged this gift that was given to them by extraordinary people to create more of, you know, like it's a replica thing. You can just do it again. And I think that's why, like, it's really hard to celebrate it because while you're watching it, you're like, without that, we would have nothing. And that is actually, Australia is in quite a tenuous position, not a fortunate one.
Yeah, totally. I think if we go back to the Facebook article about the data scientist, Sophie Zhang, right, it clearly shows, if it's true, that Facebook knew they were undermining fair and free political elections, which obviously states there's got to be a role of government playing here. But it just doesn't seem like the government's playing the right role at the moment.
I think you know, just the legal proceedings in the UK with Cambridge Analytica, I don't think it was if it was true. I think it was proven in a court of law.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to a bit of global news. So if anyone who was watching the tech press globally couldn't have mistaken Snowflake listing. I mean, to be honest, I didn't know a huge amount about this company. I mean, they're sort of big data cloud provider, and it's massive. I mean, it raised $3.5 billion at a, you know, it opened at $33 billion, and since then its stock price has doubled. So it's now valued at $66 billion. So a huge IPO. Berkshire Hathaway came in the deal, which is really unusual for them. They generally steer away from IPOs. Salesforce as well announced their involvement. You know, a bit of metrics in the company. I mean, the sales doubled this year. They're up at $240 million. But, you know, to have a $66 billion company off the back of $240 million in sales, I mean, it's eye-watering. And we've touched on this in the podcast or the news podcast before, just how, you know, my perception is the stock markets are out of whack with reality. And this just seems to validate that. So I don't think anyone here is an expert in global stock markets or necessarily Snowflake, but anyone want to jump in on this one?
Well, Ian, I mean, it's worth saying, you know, there's a huge tech IPO in the midst of a range of tech IPOs that are going on and great valuations for tech companies right across the board in the US. So as you say, it's part of a sort of broader trend. And Warren Buffett doesn't invest in tech very often, but he likes this one. I think in lots of ways for Australian viewers watching US news and seeing the Snowflake IPO, I think it'll be a little bit Atlassian all over again, because no one knew who Atlassian were unless you were in the tech sector before they IPO'd either, because they're a B2B software play. And so they're not a household name. Snowflake's not a household name because they organize corporate data. It's unsexy, but it's huge money. And it's the future. So I think there's a lot of companies sort of sitting behind the consumer facing products that are the biggest sort of household names in technology that are hugely valuable. And Snowflake's exactly an example of something like that.
Yeah. And the big tech companies are queuing up now to take advantage of this. I think there was 10 companies announced that they're, I mean, this is, they haven't gone as far as filing, I don't think, but 10 US unicorn companies have announced that they want to go public. So they're in their process of heading towards that listing. So, but who knows how long this window will remain open, but right now the window is wide open and people are just launching themselves through it. So it's, you know, I guess it's healthy. I don't think there's necessarily too bad things going on here.
I mean, it's, I think part of it is also driven by the fact that other asset classes are not particularly appealing. You know, treasuries are, who wants to buy treasuries at the moment when all the governments around the world are up to their eyeballs in debt, and they're likely, you know, that debt level is going to increase because they're propping up the economy with the impacts of the pandemic. But and if you look at the stock markets, the big tech companies are the ones that are keeping the values of the stock markets generally up. So I think that investors generally, there is a bit of a flight to tech.
Yeah. Well, the cash is still out there and it needs a home. So
and realistically, the pandemic's been like quite good for lots of tech companies. Mm. People have moved online. Cloud providers have been strapped for capacity, you know, in terms of the amount of business that tech companies are doing. Lots of tech companies are actually accelerating very rapidly the uptake of their products. So there's some sense in that sort of thinking that there's some sense to the rise in the price of tech stocks.
Yeah.
We've been super surprised with our summit club around how well the founders have been doing in general.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and just the positivity and the hiring in the market too. I think we've seen great job creation out of tech in the last 9 months.
Yeah, no, the job creation's there, funding's still around, the IPO market's open. In some ways, you wouldn't think there's a global pandemic going on, but there is, you know. So again, if you're listening from Melbourne, we're feeling for you, but it's, you know, it's tough out there. But in the tech world, it doesn't seem to be as tough. So
it does depend though on your business, obviously. Yeah, if you're selling software that's for small businesses or payroll software where you're selling it on a seat by seat basis, you're going to feel this in the downwards sense. But if you're Zoom, you're the other way, obviously.
Yeah, I think some consumer businesses are doing it tough. So again, if you're listening and you were taking away that I thought it's all sunshine and roses, I know it's not. So yeah, it's very, very mixed. I mean, I think that's the punchline. Alex, on a different topic, the federal budget is in 2 weeks. I think you've already done a budget lock-in, so you can tell us all about that, but you won't be doing that this year. You can be locked in your house with a bottle of wine probably, but yeah, some clarity around R&D tax coming. Like, what else are we going to expect from the budget and the tech side?
Yeah, well, of course, this is a weird budget because it's in October. I think it's the first budget ever in October. Normally it's in May, but they pushed it back because of COVID. And now we're going to have another one in May. So it'll be just 6 months between budgets rather than 12 months. So we're actually sort of thinking about this as two budgets together. And I think lots of people in the government are thinking about it like that too, where they might have some ideas that they start in this budget and then flesh out in the next one, which is just 6 months down the track. So it'll be really interesting to see what they come up with. I think, as I said earlier, you know, it's a weird time to be in government. You're going to have to be trying to stimulate on the one hand and think about the recovery on the other hand, but also, you know, the structural effects of lots and lots and lots of debt. So big spending increases will start to be problematic over the course of the next 6 months as we see two budgets. And I think, you know, one thing that we're hearing some rumors about is that the federal government might address the disaster that has been happening with the R&D tax incentive over the last 3 years. We've had numerous reviews of what's going on with RDTI. The government's proposed some legislation to cap claims by small companies, to introduce an intensity threshold on R&D claims. And there's been no proposal yet about what's happening with software, which has really been slipping out of the R&D tax incentive for a few years. But all of that is still on hold. So that's been delayed again and again through the year. And we're likely, I think, to see some clarity one way or the other on the 6th of October, which I think will make lots of investors and founders much more comfortable with how they're using the program. And of course, this is the single biggest program to support tech companies in the country. It's a $3 billion a year program. Lots of founders rely on it.
And what's your expectation? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, look, all signs, we've been pushing for 3 years to try and get software to clarify that software is included as a core part of R&D. That was always the intention of this program from when it was first amended in 2011. And that's certainly been our line for a few years. There was a report recently put out just a few weeks ago by the government looking at fintech and doing a review of the tech sector more broadly. Andrew Bragg, a Liberal senator, was leading that. And two of the recommendations in that report were clarify that software is included in R&D, and also stop doing retrospective audits on small companies for R&D claims made in previous years. So that's the government making a recommendation to itself about what's happening with software and the R&D tax incentive. And I can only hope that they listen to themselves. and certainly, you know, that's been the message coming out of the sector for a long time is we need to get some clarity around it, and we need to stop the kind of unfair practice of backdating audits so that companies end up paying millions of dollars that they thought was theirs.
And Olympia, I'll jump to you in a sec, but I just want to ask the investor. I mean, Andrea, we can't really overstate how important the R&D tax rules are. So tell us about that from an investor side.
Well, as Alex pointed out, it is probably the biggest program. It is the biggest program supporting startups. We've got a big gap in that very early stage funding, and the R&D tax incentive is really, really important particularly for very early stage startups where they're the most vulnerable and need most support.
Yeah. Olympia?
Yeah, I'm just really concerned about the proposed cuts and then, of course, the limitations that are being discussed around how much will different companies be able to take and how it's going to be managed. Like, it's already a really complex process that requires significant amount of documentation and additional work. Like, technically, you can't, you know, most people can't even do an R&D tax credit filing without this special R&D tax credit consultant to do it for you. Like, it's not an easy process to begin with, but, you know, lots of discussions around it being put down to 13% instead of 40 and all those sorts of things, I think it make it harder again for young starting companies to push forward and make the most of their money. And I just really feel like this is a space that the government doesn't feel comfortable in and so tends to cut first. And so I'm quite concerned about this one.
Yeah. Alex?
Yeah, Olympia, if I was a betting man, I would put my money on abandoning the changes that have been proposed, because these have been there's a bill before Parliament at the moment to introduce the intensity threshold and reduce the overall payments under the RDTI, introduce a cap fee for small companies, a few problematic areas, but they'll struggle to get it through the Senate either way. It's been hugely contentious right across the economy with all sorts of R&D claimants, not just software companies, but you know, manufacturers and lots of other companies that are doing R&D. So it's politically unpopular. It's only supposed to save a couple of billion dollars a year, which last year felt like a significant amount because they were pushing for a budget surplus. This year, in a $100 billion budget deficit, it kind of doesn't look like it's worth the fight. So my expectation, and you know, this is just me guessing here, but I'd suspect they will drop that, and they might do some clarity around software as well.
Yeah.
Alex, curiosity. Alex, do you know where this has come from? Because it's been such a popular program that's helped so many companies.
Yeah, we've done a lot of thinking about that. I think it's a mix of things. Mostly it's that the RDTI has been getting more expensive every year, mostly because it's a good program. You know, any incentive program, if it's used widely, costs more each year because more companies take it up. That means more R&D is being done, but also it's costing the government more money. And in particular, it's been growing in relation to software. So back when they first introduced it in 2011, it was sort of single digits percentage of the program was software, 8 or 9%. Now it's more like 40% of the program is for software claims. And the tightening around the definition is probably driven by that, I think. And that's sort of at a bureaucratic implementation level. The bigger cuts the government says we want to make this about increasing the amount of bang for our buck under the program. So we want really R&D intensive companies to be claiming this, not companies spending, you know, 1 or 2% of revenue on R&D, but companies spending a lot of money on R&D.
Right. Anyway, Lucas, it could be a rabbit hole, this discussion. So that was awesome. Thanks, Alex. Right, let's move on. There wasn't a huge volume of deal news in the last couple of weeks, but there was a couple that caught our eye. So Andrew, I might throw this one to you. So it was our Kiwi friends, First AML. You know, Gilex knows a little bit about this one, but yeah, they announced they just raised $7.3 million. So what's your take on this one?
I think it's awesome. It was a good investment opportunity. It was led by a US fund. First AML is a New Zealand company that provides an automated solution to the increasing compliance burden. And
anti-money laundering, that's the AML of the First AML.
Exactly. So we're a customer of First AML. We love them. It takes a lot of the really tedious work in meeting our compliance obligations off our laps. And I think there's an anticipated sort of second tranche of regulatory requirements around this so that they'll apply to, lawyers and accountants and others. So the market is massively expanding. So, yeah, I think it's great news.
For the uninitiated out there, like, give us a glimpse into the compliance regime that, you know, funds and others have to go in for. Why do we need this?
Oh, well, look, anti-money laundering is to make sure that you're not laundering money for criminals. So you need to know exactly who you're accepting. You know, if an investor's investing through, you need to know exactly who that investor is. So it's one thing if it's, see someone's passport and it's an individual. It's a totally different thing if it's hidden behind a big complex web of, corporate structure or trust structure. And it gets very complex, very expensive and time consuming. So First AML is solving a very painful and acutely painful problem.
Yeah. And they've come from nowhere. But it's a young company, three young guys. And, I think they raised it over 30 million. Well, you assume it's going to be up there if you're raising 7.3.
It was a big valuation.
So it's, it's a great company. and a fascinating deal from our Kiwi friends. Another deal that we saw, Safety Culture buying EdApp. Luke Anier, who's Safety Culture CEO, said, we're experiencing the biggest workplace shakeup since economies were rebuilt after World War II. So again, it's all around training. So it's a nice fit. You know, Safety Culture seems to be buying a few more. So anyone got any thoughts on this, Andrea?
Oh, one of the things I love about, I mean, it was a bit of a no-brainer for them in that it's the direction that they, you know, it's a really kind of logical direction is to add on the educational and training piece but to their offering. But one of the things that excites me about this is it's kind of reflective of the maturation of our ecosystem. You know, companies like Safety Culture are growing and purchase, you know, acquiring a company, a smaller company like EdApp that provides an exit. It also provides training for more entrepreneurs. And I think, you know, it's just very good for the whole ecosystem.
Super healthy. Yeah, we've got a news topic, a couple of items down about Atlassian. You know, they've apparently made 20 acquisitions so far. But anyway, we'll get on to that. Alex, there was one that caught our attention that and I know you were across. So Canva, Airwallex, and CultureAmp, so three of our best-known, most successful startups. They're on the Forbes Cloud 100 list of top private companies. So Canva's apparently the only non-US company in the top 10. The average valuation of the whole top 100 is 2.7 billion US. So, I mean, the valuations, again, we've touched on this, but it's just going up and up. But, you know, three Aussie companies on that list. Is that good?
Sensational. Yeah, I mean, there's actually only seven non-American companies on that list in total, and three of them are Australian. They list Airwallex as being headquartered in Hong Kong, which, you know, I object to, but we're claiming them. They can be the Pavlova of Australia. But yeah, I mean, this is brilliant. Canva comes in at number seven, you know, first time top 10. Just, you know, this is the kind of stuff that puts Australian businesses on the global radar. And there's lots more to come. You know, I think one of the really exciting things about the ecosystem at the moment, Andrea touched on increasing sort of M&A propensity for Australian businesses. It's just that maturation, right? It's about companies suddenly starting to play on the global stage, look to acquire other businesses rather than be acquired themselves. I mean, for a long time, if you were an Australian startup, you were much more likely to be acquired by a big US tech company than by an Australian corporate or peer. These days, that's starting to shift, and there are definitely acquirers like Atlassian and Canva and Safety Culture out there who are looking to make acquisitions. So I think all of that, these, you know, big valuations and acquisitions increasing, all that tells you that this is a sector, this is an ecosystem that's maturing really nicely.
Yeah. More deal news or rumored deal news. So Alibaba apparently in talks to invest $3 billion in Grab, which is an Uber competitor. I think Grab's headquartered in Singapore. Am I right with that, Olympia? Any thoughts on this one?
I just find it really interesting given how challenging it's been for Uber in the last little bit. And this is about Alibaba's buying Uber's share of Grab, which was like 20-some percent of Grab.
Interesting.
It's a super interesting there's been a lot of talk about whether or not the gig economy can do well given in post-COVID world and the challenges to keeping continuity of business in times such as COVID. So this sort of size investment and certainly removing Uber from the cap table, I just thought was such an interesting move. Grab is far more popular in Asia than Uber ever was. And so when Uber left, it was easily filled. But I'm super interested to see where this one goes because I'm still on the fence about ride sharing, even though I use ride sharing all the time.
Well, even now, like I think I've made like, I don't know, 2000 Uber rides in the last 5 years and one in the last 6 months. So are you still active?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm very much still using them. I think because I have done it myself, I've been a driver myself. I know that, yeah.
What the startup hustle. Love it.
Well, and it's also like you're like, please get a ride, somebody, please. So.
I think, I mean, I'm using Uber more now. Well, you know, in terms of if I'm getting in a car, I'm in an Uber, never a taxi, because they've got my details. They can give me a call if the Uber driver had COVID or someone else in the Uber that day had COVID. I'm going to get contacted. Whereas there's a case right now, if anyone in sort of southwestern Sydney who was in a taxi between a 10-day date range is being told they need to go and self-isolate or get a COVID test because one taxi driver in southwestern Sydney over a 10-day period had COVID. And of course, you just pick him up off the street and he doesn't have your details. So that's made me more likely to get an Uber than a taxi.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
So interesting. Yeah.
Atlassian, once again in the news. So they've announced a $70 million fund. I mentioned before, I didn't realize this, it was this number. I knew they'd be making some acquisitions, but 20 acquisitions in total, totaling more than $1 billion in value. I mean, I think the stock prices or their market cap is about $50 billion. I might be a little wrong on that, but it's right up there. I think maybe came off the boil a little bit. So Andrea, as the investor in the room, any thoughts on Atlassian starting to do this?
Well, going back to what I said earlier, I think it's awesome. It's part of the whole ecosystem maturing, which is great for Australia. It's great for job creation. And I think Atlassian's already, I think it's done about 20 acquisitions anyway.
Yes, 20.
So this is just, I think, probably formalizing that process.
Although this is investment, not just acquisition.
So yeah,
it's just
yeah,
a
yeah.
new arm to their corporate affairs team.
Yep.
Not fair, sort of corporate development team.
Yep, absolutely. But the thing is that they're formalizing their structure for investing. And obviously that is separate to the acquisitions. But what's great about that is that it's feeding money back into the ecosystem and back into startups. It's providing exits. It's providing much needed investment. But I think what's really particularly valuable about this fund is that the dollar investment comes coupled with coaching and mentoring from the sort of senior Atlassian people themselves, which is just a great feeding back into our ecosystem, the expertise that Atlassian has developed that's built them into such an impressive company.
Yeah. And again, Alex, I'll throw this to you. Atlassian, I mean, they really are the poster child. We can't have a news podcast without talking about them several times. But the thing I loved about this article, this was in the AFR, there was a quote from the Atlassian spokesperson that said, "The healthier our ecosystem is, the healthier Atlassian will be. This is a mechanism to enhance the value of our ecosystem and drive some investment dollars into it." So they're giving back. Alex?
Yeah. I mean, this is the dream, isn't it? You build billion-dollar businesses and then the founders and others, early employees make some money and they it reinvested back into the ecosystem. And that's why it's called an ecosystem, because it's got that kind of cyclical, growing, organic nature about it. And so that's what's happening here, absolutely. And this is an Atlassian fund for companies building on the Atlassian platform, right? So this is, couldn't possibly be truer that if those companies do well, then Atlassian does well. So this is very much about growing both the startup ecosystem broadly and specifically the Atlassian ecosystem. Salesforce does a similar thing for companies building on Salesforce. They've got a $50 million venture fund where they're investing in companies in Australia too. Yeah. It's smart business. And of course, if you are a company who's eligible to get money from this fund, you should also be talking to Mike and Scott with Grok and Skip Capital. So you're probably on the radar there too. So there's plenty.
A great segue to Olympia. Like, so you took money from Grok. So, I mean, Mike, what's your observation of this story and Mike's involvement in the ecosystem?
I don't think there's really any question about how in touch both Mike and Scott are with the needs for founders to be supported and what it takes to build a company like Atlassian. And so, like, the fact that they understand that and have found ways to deploy their capital to not only like invest in great companies and create ecosystems, but to like back people who are starting like they did, I think. And the fact that they can do it in a way that is sort of a self-licking ice cream cone where they're feeding back into themselves, like, I think that just shows how much they understand it, right? Because then it's good for everyone. So yeah, it's unpredictable, but still so incredibly great.
Yeah, I don't know what a self-licking ice cream cone is, but that sounds amazing. It sounds great. Andrea, any last words in this one?
Yeah, look, I think we're particularly lucky in Australia, that we've got people like Mike Cannon-Brookes and Scott Farquhar at the sort of top of the pyramid. And, you know, I think it's generally accepted that culture is set from the top, and they're key players that are setting the culture from the top, I think, in terms of our startup ecosystem. I've been enormously grateful for the kind of gratuitous generosity in, you know, some of the, I suppose, the higher profile people just being supportive of me. And I know that that's part of the culture of this ecosystem. And I think we're really lucky, because I think, you know, in other places like Silicon Valley, it is a little more swimming with sharks. And yeah, I think it's a much more supportive system. Yeah. I get the feeling it's a much more supportive system here.
No, I think it's great. All right, so more funding news, but funding news for funds. So James Alexander, who used to run Incubate, and Hugh Stevens, who is a buddy of his, they've announced that they've closed $10 million in a new fund called Galileo. Now, it's partly fun, but it's also got an accelerator program off to the side of this. So again, look, good news. I mean, it's taken them, you know, they talked about the journey, and we know how hard it is to raise a fund. So like, hats off to them, but they were at this for 3 years. Andrea, any thoughts as the investor in the room?
Oh, I think it's really encouraging. It's great news. We've, you know, we've had a few articles in the press recently, you know, this year since the COVID pandemic struck, about people struggling to raise a first fund, or even struggling to raise a third fund, one where they've decided to bail out entirely and trying to raise a first fund because they're saying it's so hard at the moment. But it's interesting because, you know, LPs are off. Obvious, a lot of potential LPs are clearly saying, we just want to wait and see. But on the other side of it, you know, we've just seen phenomenal activity in the angel, you know, the seed and pre-seed stage investing amongst angels. We've done, you know, our business model is to basically lead angel, you know, pre and early revenue rounds. And we've done four in the last, I think it's about 6 weeks, that have been the most successful we've ever had. We had one, I think, oversubscribed a couple of times in about 20 minutes, which we've never had before. We had a couple more that were oversubscribed by more than 2x in less than 2 days. So,
but this is consistent across, I mean, all the angel groups and the sort of syndicate investors. So Eleanor and Matt Allen and there's several others. I mean, Alex, are you hearing the same story of, you know, syndicate groups and angel investment activity high?
Yeah, I'm definitely hearing angel investment is high. The numbers suggest that seed is down, you know, that's just looking at the PitchBook numbers for Australia, which don't capture lots of angel investment. So anecdotally, yes, great activity at the angel space. I think, you know, Australia's got a bit of a problem at seed anyway. Have had for the last couple of years kind of a falling aggregate total dollars invested and number of deals. And you can imagine why investors would sort of not be jumping in at seed stage at the moment if they could be investing in companies that they already knew and have had a track record. So there might be still a gap there, but it's encouraging to hear that there's lots happening at the angel level.
There is still a gap, but you know, our experience and what we're seeing, I think, validates that. And Faden, like, I mean, like Innovation Bay has been doing some stuff in the, I mean, we've always been active in the angel community. So, but I mean, we're seeing good opportunities for, you know, in fact, we're talking about it, launching this angel club. So can you tell us about that?
Well, we're not talking about it, we're doing it. But I think this year's been the major winner, hasn't it, for venture in general and angel funding, to Alex's point. I think the US data was sort of saying that valuations have come down. We haven't really seen that hugely in Australia as yet. And we've definitely seen a lot of activity on the angel side, but obviously Blackbird raising their fund, a lot of the VC firms building out their teams. It just seems like a lot of liquidity is moving into tech at the moment, whether that's through angel or VC. So we're super excited to be launching our angel club, which will be launching officially in November. Hopefully we're going to make a bit of a dent because it's needed.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's nationwide as well. I mean, because the reality is there's money across the country, so you don't have to live in Sydney or even Melbourne to, not even Melbourne, I shouldn't put it that way. That sounded disparaging, which is never meant to be. But yeah, it's open to any angel investor across the country. So, all right, let's roll on. We've probably got still another 10 minutes or so. So what other news did we see? So Rampersand's hired a new investment manager. So Taryn Patrese. I don't know Taryn. I don't think any of us do, in fact. But again, it's just it's a positive sign that investors are out there hiring people to join their investment team. So global deal. NVIDIA is buying chipmaker Arm off SoftBank for $40 billion. Good on SoftBank. They paid $31 billion for it in 2016. So they've made some money. So yeah, they're going to be happy about that. But Alex, you're nodding. Any thoughts? I mean, this is a big deal. In Arm's a UK a chip maker, but the only competitor to Intel out there. So what's your thinking in this one?
Yeah, I think it's a big deal for the chip sector. I think it's probably good for SoftBank, but it's only relatively modest return, really.
Yeah.
Over 4 years. 20% or something, which is good, but I think SoftBank are looking to make more than that. But considering the other investments SoftBank's in at the moment, they're probably pleased to make 20% on anything, especially at scale.
What else? Other big deal news. Again, I don't want to dwell too much in this because I don't think we should be talking too much about it, but TikTok. I mean, it's a massive company. I mean, it's kind of swallowed up in the whole US political BS, but Oracle and Walmart seem to be likely, which just seems bizarre. Like you can't imagine two more unlikely bedfellows to house the coolest teenage sensation out there. Olympia, you're smiling on that one. Have you got any thoughts on TikTok?
Oh, I think it's the most predictable, right? Like that TikTok's super powerful, and it's powerful because it's organic. And so it wouldn't even be like where most of these platforms have been looking at ad plays, like Walmart could do something really creative here from a social engineering perspective because TikTok is its own. Yeah, there's something really interesting about the TikToks and the Snapchats and where the platform to be used as a pay-to-play click situation isn't what's going on. And so then you create this organic, very powerful user base that, yeah, anyone who has access to it has access to something a bit more interesting than the average. And Walmart knows that, and it knows it has to refresh its brand because yeah, right now it's synonymous with old fat rednecks.
But it is a bit disappointing. I mean, again, it goes back to the first story that we talked about, just government intervention and, you know, turning tech into somewhat of a political football. You know, I don't think it should be. So Alex, any thoughts on TikTok and whether or not it should be this political football?
Oh, I think it's the US right now is a crazy place to be living, doing business, watching. So anything goes, really. The one thing that sticks out for me from this story is that Microsoft has dodged a massive bullet. I think when Microsoft were looking like the most likely acquirers of TikTok, thinking about Microsoft's positioning over the last 4 or 5 years, they have artfully managed to dodge the huge global political headwinds against technology firms. No one says Facebook, Google, and Microsoft. People say Facebook and Google because Microsoft has said, oh, we're not about consumers. We're about business. We're an enterprise brand. We're really boring. Don't worry about us. Of course, they actually own a social media company, LinkedIn, but you know that's a corporate, business social media company. So they managed to still dodge the bullet. But if they bought TikTok, I mean, this is all the things that Microsoft's trying not to be when it comes to their reputation, at least with politicians. It's consumer focused. There's so much content stuff on TikTok that they'd have to worry about in terms of online safety. You know, just last week there was the whole thing about a suicide video on TikTok. So I think, certainly for Microsoft Australia, and I think globally for Microsoft's brand, owning TikTok would have totally flipped on its head what Microsoft's been trying to do for the last half decade.
Yeah. All right, we've got time maybe for one more story to discuss. So the government, this is Innovation Oz, the government has spent $5 million so far in the COVID Safe app. But when The Guardian asked them for user data, I mean, they talk about the download data, but the government steadfastly refused to disclose any amount of user data. So how many people are using it, whether it's been successful, et cetera. Alex, is this a good spend of government money?
Do you know what? I think it is a good spend of government money. Because like the reason they're not giving the data on whether it's been successful is because we know it hasn't been successful, at least in terms of identifying COVID cases that weren't otherwise identified by contact tracing. But what it has been successful at is it was the reason we reopened. I mean, it was basically, it was the safety net sort of comfort blanket that the government needed. The download, the COVID safe download numbers was the comfort blanket the government needed to reopen economies around the country. And so actually in lots of ways, if that cost $5 million, I'm sure the return for the country is much more than $5 million, even if it's only an extra week or two of having the economy open. So I'm seeing these articles in Innovation Oz every other day and thinking, BCG is making a lot of money off COVID safe and the government spent $5 million. Okay, seems outlandish, but realistically, I think,
yeah, in the scheme of things, I'd do it again. It's not a huge amount of money. And you're right. I mean, it is opening the, I hadn't thought about it that way. I think that's a fascinating way of thinking of it. Andrea, any thoughts on the COVID safe app? No.
I think I agree with Alex, but I also think it's a little bit disappointing that it would have been nice if, you know, we could have said, well, you know, the COVID Safe Act's been really helpful and blah, 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 because it would have helped the image of technology, you know, after the, you know, the election where they bungled the sort of messaging about tech, and so many people in Australia think tech is going to take away jobs and are frightened by it rather than being aware that tech creates most jobs in Australia.
Yeah.
So most new jobs.
It would have been great if the government could produce a great tech product, of course. You know, it's not great that they spent $5 million on a product that didn't do anything. But fundamentally, I think it's probably okay. Actually, if we got 1 minute, I think there's a really interesting thing coming in this space, which is once there's a vaccine for COVID, I think for some years after that, there's going to need to be an evidence, probably a digital product of evidence that you've had the vaccine. So I don't know if anyone remembers that you used to have to get a yellow fever card when you're traveling to South America. And I think prior to that, lots of parts of the world, to say, yes, I've had a yellow fever vaccine in the last 5 years. You'll absolutely need something like that, I think, for COVID. And that, you know, that'll be a thing you show at border controls all around the world. And so the first company and government to do a partnership on an app like that, I think there'll be money to be made there.
Yeah, and reassure us all. Maybe I'll ask Olympia this there first, as the sort of scientist, ag tech person. Are you going to take the COVID vaccine when it first comes out?
Sure.
Yeah.
Me too. Like, science is science, man. Yeah.
At least here we can have some confidence that scientific ways of knowing have been kind of respected. And, you know, I sort of worry about the vaccine in Russia, and I do worry about Trump throwing his weight around to get a vaccine out, prior to the election prematurely.
Yeah, but let's be real, that's not the scientists doing bad
science. No, it's not.
That's the tragedy about that whole power. Yeah.
It is.
But the good news is, Olympia, that the vaccine appears to show every sign that it's going to work. I mean, it's, you know, there might be differences with it, but it's not like the HIV was a challenge, and I think there are some other hepatitis and a few others you just can't vaccinate against, but it looks like you will be able to with COVID. Is that right?
It's definitely looking that way. And I think really what we just have to ensure, to Andrew's point, is that there's rigor that we normally would follow in non-traumatic times to push that across. And I think that's right to be afraid that some nations may err on the side of speed to try and, you know, fix a problem. But I think overwhelmingly that, you know, the speed in which scientists have got this stage is like incredible. And surely we will see our sort of a general opening. But I think Alex Wright, well, you know, this will be a sort of a rabies vaccine or a malaria something, and off we'll pop. And we do this with all sorts of things. You take pills for malaria, you take stuff for dengue, like, you know, this is not unusual. We have to stop pretending that these are things we do all the time in other situations. So,
folks, we are out of time. So I want to give a massive thank you. So Olympia, I think you said there's a storm coming through Canberra, so your internet was up and down, but we didn't notice. So that was awesome. Thank you. Right. Andrea, thanks for being here in the living room with me together. That was awesome.
Thanks so much for having me.
No problem. Anytime. And Alex, thank you.
Good to be here. Thanks, Ian.
And Faden, as ever. Good to have you. All right. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you all on the next one.